One of the great theologians of our time, Mary Hinderly.
Well, I should rise, Lord. A lot of doctorates are in my pack and stuff. No, I'm not going to do that since I don't have any. It's hard to you know, pick them up just because Leo suggests it. I think Carol announced this morning that I would be talking to you on George MacDonald, who is the sometimes unknown but very strong motivating force, at least in the English series of authors, of some of the great imaginative writing that's been done, not only for children but for adults in the last, particularly in the last part of the first half of our 20th century. I think that I'm going to spend a little more time than I did last week when I talked about George MacDonald himself. I'm going to spend a little more time in suggesting some of the children's books that are available to you right now that follow in this particular style of writing, because I've discovered through the years up here that there are many, many people who don't know some of the, what I consider not some of the best, but I consider the best books for children, if you're at all concerned about the fact that your children's imagination should be baptized along with the rest of them. That phrase, by the way, comes from George MacDonald himself, who believed very firmly or I think it was C.S. Lewis who talked about the fact that George MacDonald had baptized his imagination into the whole world of Christian thinking and Christian life. How many of you, by the way, do know the books of C.S. Lewis? Now, the rather doctrinal books, but the books of fairy stories that he's written, the Narnia series. Mm-hmm. Would you raise your hands high enough so I know if I'm repeating something that I should know? Well, fine. You won't mind if I mention them then, because most people who like the C.S. Lewis books for children are addicts. And every time they hear somebody talking about it, they say, yay, rah, this is our stuff, it's coming up to the top again. Because as you see, now, you're a really good representative group of women, and a lot of you have never read them and have probably never even seen them. The amazing thing about these books is that they're just as much fun for you to read as they are for you to read to your children or to read to your grandchildren or your nieces or your nephews or whatever. They're just as interesting to boys as to girls. They are, they feed the imagination in the most tremendous way that I know, and I think this is the greatest vacuum in our present society is the paucity, the aridity of the imaginative life of the American people, at least. What happens about the European people, I don't know, but we're concerned about our society, and this is where our particular mission in our life is. Before I talk about George MacDonald, I want to talk about the C.S. Lewis books, because you may have gone to sleep by the time, because, you know, this room gets hot and, you know, it gets to be toward noon, and pretty soon you've heard a lot of people talking, and I don't care how strong the coffee is, there gets to be a tendency of nodding and not always in agreement about 11:30. So I'm going to take the first part of this talk on the C.S. Lewis books, because much as I love George MacDonald, I know you aren't going to go home and find any of his books. They're hard to get, hard to come by, even in libraries. But you can buy C.S. Lewis books, and they should be in every church library. I get really fed up on this Well, not so much now, because I think the general format has improved, but believe me, religion was dull. Dull, dull, dull. If you looked at the kind of books that came out for children's consumption in general. And I don't know, now you, okay, you can call me a heretic. It's all right. I mean, I've been called heretics by lots of people, and I'm not thinking about you as being members of the Missouri Synod that you'd call me a heretic, but lots of Christians think that the minute you move into the world of the imagination, wow, you're in trouble, you're going to get into a trap of Satan, and believe me, human beings were not made to ask questions. They were made to memorize answers. And and I lay my salvation on the understanding that I learned in Luther's Small Catechism. But I have a horror of the fact that just like that little girl last night, I have all the answers, and lots of good answers, but I don't know the questions. And this is what has been the fright to me in our whole Lutheran concept, is that we have implanted questions before the questions were there and told people, you've got to learn this. This is the right question to ask, just as if we were religious computers, as if we didn't trust the Holy Spirit in the work of the scriptures to produce this. And as I say, I'm a firm believer in memorizing the Small Catechism. Now, try to fit those two together. Well, that's your problem, huh? I can live with it. But actually, this is a real problem. And why the little girl last night was in such a quandary, and why so many people are in quandaries, because of the fact that they don't have the right questions. So therefore, the computers don't give the right answers. That's right, isn't it? That's the way it comes. You've got to have the right question in order to get the right answer. But what happens when your imagination is being fed in the right way is that those questions come to the top, because you become, your children become, the people around you become the thinkers that God intended them to be. What's a parable for?
Make you think.
Right. It isn't just a subject for a sermon, is it? Sometimes it really bothers me, because all the parables are always spewed forth in a kind of a beautiful little pattern that you could buy by the bolt sort of thing. And you wonder if the person who has been exposed to that parable has thought about it. Well, the parables are the image, the originating force and the idea out of which this whole life of the imagination has sprung, and out of which we have this great spate of children's books called the Narnia series, and later the Tolkien books, which have become the interest and the hobby of teenagers and adults. And because of the fact that when Jesus told a story, it was a good story, wasn't it? I mean, like the prodigal. Is that a story or isn't it a story? I mean, if you read that just by itself, do you have to know that Jesus was talking about God, about a lost soul, about a rebel, or do you just, can you read it as a story and say, that's it, that's what happens? Isn't it true? It is a story. In and of itself, it's exciting, it's interesting, it's there. And so many of Jesus' parables are like that. They are their stories in and of themselves. They have a whole plot idea in them, enough to write a novel on it, and lots of novels have been written. And this is the form that this whole group of writers, of which C.S. Lewis is one of the greatest, has taken, the idea of the parable or the image, the idea of taking a story that is good in and of itself and writing it, but impregnating it with all the ideas and the force and the excitement of another world. The stories that C.S. Lewis has written have enchanting names. But now, you better stop being the age you are for a little while and forget it. And just think of this one name: The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. What possible connection could they have? It's just not important. To a child, do things have to have connections? How many of you think that, or have you forgotten how children are? Do things have to be connected? 1, 2, 3. How quickly does a child move from the world of imagination back to the world of I'm hungry? You don't have to be a child. Why, no, sir, you don't have to be a child to move that fast. But this is true, isn't it? That a child can be living in two worlds at the same time. No problem. You move from, I don't know, but Sarah doesn't want to come right now. Who's Sarah? Well, she's the girl I'm playing with. You can't see Sarah, can you? She isn't there. But she is there for your little daughter, your niece, your grandchild. She's an exciting person in this life of imagination that this child is living. Well, do you want to ask Sarah to lunch? I don't know. Sarah, do you want to come for lunch? No, she doesn't want to eat any lunch, but I think I'll eat lunch now, Mommy. And back she comes and she eats lunch and she's perfectly happy. She's talking to you and she hasn't changed her ways. She hasn't changed her person. She's moved, though, back and forth into two worlds. No problem. Now, don't get the idea, you're going to say that religion is a fairy tale, you know, that this is the same as all these people that talk about myths. That isn't what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is that for the world of a child, the world of the imagination can be moved, you can move back and forth with no trouble. And if you and I are to remain young, and apparently this is the idea if you look at, 17 and Glamour and Mademoiselle and then you read and you look at Good Housekeeping, 25 new hairdos to make you feel young again. If all these things are continually being thrown at you, then maybe we ought to start asking ourselves, how true was it when Jesus said, except you become as little children, you cannot enter into the kingdom of God, and except you be born again and again and again. And the baptism that we received as adoption into the family of God is a continually renewing power, and it makes us young. And that's why I can talk to adults about the Narnia series, about C.S. Lewis and the children's books, and not feel that I have to apologize and say, first, this is really for your children. This is what I said at the beginning to sort of bait you and, kind of put you off your guard. But it isn't. It's for you and me just as much as it's for them. My father, when he was 80 years old, visited us in Norway, and we were reading the Narnia series out loud. The kids were reading it to each other. And my father, who used to be president of one of the Lutheran synods for about 28 years and knew considerable about theology, and he was so fascinated that he grabbed the book, grabbed. When the children went to bed, he chewed on a cigar and said, where's that book? Got the book, and he sat over there by the fireplace, and then he got out his pipe, and he read, and finally I said, Father, you got to go to bed. I said, I have to finish this book, because he said, I won't have a chance to get at it tomorrow. The kids will start in again. And I said, that's okay. Well, he finished it. And he was so excited about it that he read as many of the books as we had there. Now, what makes the book exciting? The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Completely non sequitur, that just doesn't connect. But it does, because the lion is a great, wonderful, frightening lion, golden and beautiful. What other lion do we know about in Scripture? Yeah, right, but there's another lion. No, not just that lion. That's true. That is an image that C.S. Lewis just ignores. Samson. What else? The Lion of what? The Lion of Judah. Sure, the Lion of Judah. And here's the Lion of Judah only. Don't kid yourselves that you're going to be told anything in any term that you've already got any hackles up about. You're going to be caught completely off guard. It's really too bad that I tell you this, because when you read it, you're not going to be caught off guard, because I've already warned you. But you know, sometimes people have to be kind of, the whole thing has to be kind of opened up, because there's so many other things to read and do that you have to really feel this is really important, and I believe this is really important. I feel it's as important as I believed last year when I told you, and I still believe, that Luther is essential to every woman's reading. The Lion of Judah. Now, you never see that term. It's just the lion. And his name is Aslan. The witch. Well, the witch doesn't have any counterpart exactly, unless you think of the Witch of Endor, in the scriptures. But she freezes up everything. Now, we always think about hell as being fire, you know. But there's something very awful about people that are frozen, isn't there? People that are rigid. They're no longer moving with warmth. They're like this. This is what the witch does in the story. The wardrobe. How many of you know what a wardrobe is? And I don't mean, you know, a man's, how many shirts are you supposed to have for a wardrobe? 20, you know? It's in these old-fashioned closets. The ones we have over in the lodges are wardrobes, but they're fastened. But these were movable ones that they had in England, and they have them all over Europe. It opens up. And this wardrobe, do you know what happens? You walk through it. You walk through it, and it's the entry to another world, a completely strange and wonderful world, peopled with elves and witches and animals that talk. Now, the interesting thing is that what is it, Leo, that you call the thing that isn't a variable? The constant in this kind of a situation is that the children are still children. They're still human beings. They walk through the wardrobe into this world of Narnia, and they talk to all these people. In other words, the children didn't learn the language of the animals, but the animals are talking the language that the children understand. And the witch can communicate with the children in no uncertain terms. And this is all, what's wonderful about it is that it makes you realize that the human being is still a human being in both worlds. As the children move back and forth, they don't become anything different from what they were. They have the same sins, and boy, those sins are nasty, they're cruddy, they're gritty, they're murderous. And they also have the same virtues, the same humor, the same beauty, and the same loveliness that children have, and that you and I have, because we're all children. And they walk back and forth, they can walk back and forth through this wardrobe. Well, actually, of course, what happens is that when they walk through the wardrobe, they come into the land of Narnia. And this is where the story begins. And I'm not going to tell you the story. That's what you have to find out. But it's exciting. And do you know that a woman whom I love very much and who I respect highly, because she has such a wonderfully childlike mind, was furious with me when I said, "Well, this is a whole story of salvation." And she said, "I think that's terrible that you read all that into it." She said, "That's a wonderful story all by itself. Don't talk about that." And it wasn't that she wasn't a Christian, but she thought I was trying to implant a moral sort of a, you know, "Now, children, you must watch to see where is justification, where does sanctification come in, now where do we find the Trinity?" You know, that isn't the thing. But it does come to the essential sort of what you could say is the cornerstone and the stumbling block of the whole understanding of Christ and the cross in the understanding of the sacrifice of the lion. And the amazing thing is, as Carol mentioned, I think, to somebody the other day, yesterday, the kids understand this. They catch on. They said, "Well, you know, this is, you know, Luther's small catechism." Exactly. Of course it isn't spelled out, but it's told in an imaginative way that feeds something in children that has to be fed, or you're going to have trouble. Right here in River City, you're going to have trouble. And that's what happens when the imagination is nurtured and filled and stimulated by something other than, you know, the kind of stuff that comes off of TV. And a lot of good things come off of TV. I'm not disparaging the medium, but there's got to be some place where we develop another side to our lives and our children's lives. And don't kid yourselves that your kids are sitting around unaware of the fact that you and I are just reading magazines and never reading books, except when we have to give a talk. They're not fooled. So if you feel rather disgusted because your children aren't reading, you might ask yourselves, how often have they seen me read, or how often have I taken time to read something together with them? It's not easy. Even if you love books, it isn't easy. So this is what I would like to say about the C.S. Lewis books. Now, are there any questions? There are 7 of those books, and they have, I have one of them up here, the rest of them are all out. But we do have a full set in the library. This one is called The Horse and His Boy, and this is the next to the last one in the set. But they do have them also, are coming out now in paperback. They're coming from England. If any of you ever go up to Victoria, you'll find them in the Penguin, in the Puffin books, which is the children's books from the Penguin series. But we also have them put out. The Macmillan Company has apparently bought the rights to use these Puffin books here, and you can get The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in paperback here in the States. The others, I don't know whether they're available, but it's worth it to go to take a trip to Victoria just to visit the bookshops. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Doris.
They're available at the author of the Who's in the Parish of Lion, Seattle.
In hardback. Well, that isn't too bad. They are expensive. They're $3.95, and you know, you just think, oh. But you know, as I said about Luther last year, I'm glad you mentioned that fact, because the money we spend on stuff that isn't going to make any difference to people is, you know, yeah.
Well, and you can write to James Thin too, Mary.
Yeah.
I get mine from James Thin in
Scotland.
59 Southbridge at Edinburgh. And,
well,
you know, they cost about 40 cents a piece.
The only trouble is, you know, Leo, is that I know myself that if there's a lot of monkey business to getting something, you don't buy it.
I and just write them a letter.
Yeah. You're better at writing letters than some. But this is true. If, for instance, for a church library, think how great it would be to have several editions available. I mean, several of copies. If you could buy the paperbacks, you'd have some on hand. Yeah.
What ages do you advocate this book for?
Well, my youngest was about 5 when we started in, and they're still reading them, and they're 21, 23, 25, and 28.
I'd say 5 to 105.
Mm-hmm. I'd say that too.
What about a Christmas gift?
Great Christmas presents. I'd advise you to read it first. Then you can decide if you want to give it away. You might want to keep it. But it's a very good, and they're one, and you know they're wonderful. They're wonderful birthday presents. They're wonderful presents to give. I suppose you wouldn't think that you should give them for confirmation, but I should think at the age of confirmation they should be old enough to decide if they can, you know, sift the truth from the error. Yeah?
We did find one at the public library.
Oh, yes, they are in the public library, most public libraries anyway. What town are you from?
Spokane.
From Spokane?
In the county.
Well,
match, but we
push it. Push it. Ask for them. They will order. If you ask for them at your public library, they'll order them. Well, yes, that's what I said. Get them in your church library. But, you know, I know the funds for libraries aren't always large, but they're so much better than a stack of devotional books that nobody reads. So I just believe firmly that something has to be done. And I'd like to read this quote from John Paul Sartre, who... some of you may recognize as one of the famous French existentialists, a great and writer of wide reputation, who is an admitted and confessed professing atheist. I read his biography, his autobiography, Words, and I was struck with what happened to him as a child and why he turned away from the church. Deep down, it all bored me to death. I was led to unbelief not through conflicting dogma, but through my grandparents' indifference. He lived with his grandparents a good deal of the time. Not through conflicting dogma, but for my grandparents' indifference. And this is why I think you need to fill your bookshelves with a few really good, exciting, interesting books. And don't figure that you gotta have them, you know, always coming out of a Lutheran publishing house. Because that oftentimes certainly turns teenagers off, and it very often will turn children off, because it's obviously trying to teach them a lesson. But if it's a good story, they'll read it. And I think if Jean-Paul Sartre had a chance to read something like this, it might have, who can tell, it might have made a difference if there'd been a French C.S. Lewis in his life. He said, for several years longer, I kept up public relations with the Almighty. In private, I stopped associating with him. And it's this private association with the Almighty that C.S. Lewis has a lot to do with. Then I would also like to just bring one more quote in from G.K. Chesterton, who is an interesting Englishman, who said that for fallen men, it is often true that familiarity is fatigue. Familiarity is fatigue. Now, we often say familiarity breeds contempt. Well, that's all the way. Now, we've said that little cliche and we've covered the ground. But he says it in a different way. He says familiarity is fatigue, boredom. And this is what happens with the words that we've become too accustomed to in the life of the church. We've gotten bored with them, so we turn them off. They no longer excite us. And this is where something that in the world of the imagination can stimulate and take you back so that you meet them in another way and they hit you again. They turn you on again. They're new again. And this is the work of the Holy Spirit. I do firmly believe that the Holy Spirit is not only the spirit of memory, but also the spirit of the imagination, the spirit that relates us to all of the world of God in the universe. Well, this is why I am talking to you for the rest of the time on a strange man called George MacDonald, who got kicked out of his parishes because he was not the proper kind of a preacher. For one thing, he had a beard. Have you heard that before? I suppose he had sideburns. But this Scotch church said, if you would shave your beard, we possibly could keep you on. Now, do you know when he was living? About the middle half of the last century. Beards have been such a problem, and I don't know why, when Jesus had such a long one. And we talk about the, you know, who is it, Aaron's beard, and I don't know what makes beards so, you know, so suspect. As long as they're kept combed, I should think they could be allowed. But this was one of the things that the church wouldn't have in George MacDonald, because he had a beard. But then he had a lot of other things too. He had a lot of ideas on the love of God. He couldn't take the Calvinist approach. He just couldn't swallow it. And he continued to preach that God's love in Christ was such that it just had to swallow men up. It just had to embrace them. It had to cover them. And somehow those Calvinists, they wanted to be sure of election first before they talked about the love of God. Well, Luther could have done a great deal with him. In fact, his own son, when he was talking about him in his biography, said George MacDonald was a Luther, not an Erasmus. He was a preacher. He was an inspired person. He was an overflowing spring that just bubbled and came out in torrents. And of course, it didn't come out in beautiful, you know, worked out satire and interesting allusions, as the books of Erasmus did. But it was the kind of thing that really warmed people's hearts. But not those hard-headed Scotsmen. They would have none of it. So he had to find his living in some other way, and he started writing, and he wrote a number of books. And they are, you know, they're not literary gems by any means. He wrote too much. He didn't select enough. He didn't, you know, cut off at the right place. He had to keep on talking and talking and talking about something long after he'd made his point, and people hate that. They haven't got time to read that much. So, but he did, because he lived in eternity. He had plenty of time. But this is why he was, you know, kind of looked on rather askance by the general public. Because most people'd rather get along with the ordinary than be, you know, set on fire by the out of the ordinary. And this was George MacDonald's problem. But he was, the fact that he was sort of, you know, stuck in these rather hard ways of trying to find a living, it meant that he did write some fascinating books for us to read. And I wonder how many of you have ever read At the Back of the North Wind. Do you ever? You have to be kind of old to remember it, because nowadays we've got so many fancy books that come out that, and, you know, with beautiful covers for children, that the old classics are never known anymore. They don't even read the nursery rhymes anymore. I guess they've become Freudian anyway. So, has anybody read At the Back of the North Wind? Well, has anybody read The Princess and Curdie, or The Little Light Princess? Well, these are fun books, but they are books that are what I call seminal. They're books that plant a seed that never stops growing in you, because the thoughts and the images that are presented in those books give the imagination a whole new turn. At the Back of the North Wind is about a little boy who lived in poor little boy who lived in London, and he gets acquainted with the North Wind, who comes through a crack in the coach house where he has to live. He lives upstairs in the coach house and on a little old, you know, on a hay, he has to sleep in a hay mattress up there, and there are big cracks, and the north wind comes in, and she turns out to be a woman. Long hair, black hair, and she talks to this little boy, Diamond, and asks him if he'd like to go on a trip with her sometime. And so he does, and she takes him way up, across the oceans and over the city of London. He sees so many wonderful things, and it's really fascinating to him. And then he asks her if, please, could you take me to the back of the North Wind? That's the place he wanted to go above all other places. And she says, well, I'm sorry, but it's hard for me to get to my own back. I can only sit and hear them talking at my back, but I can't get to my back. And so she says, but I can take you up there and you can go through the door yourself. Well, this is the story of his adventures. Now you might think, well, that could be something in Superman, or could be something in anything else for that matter. But what makes the difference? Well, the difference lies in the way in which it's written. That George MacDonald has taken this wonderful story and made it so full of delightful images and experiences for the child that the child who reads it is continually remembering this. In fact, G.K. Chesterton said that of all the books that he'd ever read, and that included all the novels, and he was one of the most widely read men in English letters, he said the one that stood out as the most important, the peak, was At the Back of the North Wind. Now, you get that out of the library sometime and read it and see. Ask yourself, why would a grown-up man say something like this about a children's story? The Little Light Princess and the Princess and Curdie is another story that has the same kind of mystery and strangeness to it that The Back of the North Wind has. This is about a little girl that lives in a castle and on the top of a mountain, or in a mountain, and underneath there are goblins, and they're continually moving up, pushing up, pushing up. She has to move up to another floor. And then when the goblins are mining and mining and mining, and they're getting farther up, they get up to the next floor. She has to move up to the next floor. And way at the very top lives her fairy godmother, who tells her how she can be freed from these goblins, and she starts out on this life of escape from the goblins. Now you might say, oh, I don't want my children to read about goblins, and they're going to think that there are goblins living down in the basement. And well, what's so bad about that? I mean, do you think it's better for your children to be terrorized by outer space and thinking that the people from Mars are going to be bad, and they're going to come and, as if we're so good, and of course we are the models of the universe? It just could be that the other planets, as in one of the other books of C.S. Lewis, the other planets just might still be in relationship to God. They might still be in a relationship of sonship and not in a fallen relationship as we are. I just soon have, my youngest is the one that has had the least exposure to these ideas and to these thoughts, and he's the most concerned about an invasion from Mars. He's sure that the Martians are bad, bad, bad. And you know, the rest of my kids are much more aware of the evils that are inherent in the house in which we live ourselves, and the battle that has to go on between good and evil within us. And the way in which MacDonald does this, you see, is not by making a Pilgrim's Progress out of it, which is a great book, but I bet you can't get any kids to read it. They used to, but they don't anymore, because, you know, it's kind of lost its, I guess it's lost its wildness or something. But the way George MacDonald does it, and the way C.S. Lewis does it, and the way Tolkien does it, is by creating a whole nother world that has all the same battles of good and evil, the same need of redemption, the same need of becoming disciples of the Redeemer. All these things are involved in some way or other. You don't spell them out. I mean, you can't line it up and say, now there's this and there's this and there's this. Because if you could do that, it would no longer be a story. It would be an allegory. It would be something that you'd dreamed up to fit. But this is a story in which something is taking place that you can relate very quickly to many of the great truths that you know yourself. And children learn these truths best in terms of stories. And obviously Jesus thought that grown-ups like us, who have so much sense and you know, adulthood, we learn best by stories too, because that's what he did all the time. Except when he was lashing out at some of the evils that we were all prone to do. But most of the time when he wanted to draw people, he would use a story. And this is what these great Christian storytellers have done. They've simply followed their Lord and used his method and written stories. There's nothing in the prodigal son that talks about God, is there? Is there? There isn't. Well, not in any word. There isn't a single word in the prodigal son. Can you think of one word that says God? No, there isn't. There's nothing in it at all. There's nothing in the whole story that says anything about, that uses anything about saved or forgiveness or grace or anything, except that the Father does forgive the Son. But this is something that can take place in any household. So is it so terrible to use completely other, you know, other language to express the truth that God is in Christ redeeming the world unto himself? Is it so terrible? No, it isn't. Because if you're going to do it, you know, the way that is going to be the most likely to catch men, which is what Jesus told us to do, then we have to use the bait that's going to really catch them. And the bait of the imagination is one of the best. And it's not just for children. It's also true for adults. But I think the sadness of all these writings, as far as their public response in the Christian world is concerned, and I might say particularly in the Lutheran world, because of the fact that we think we are great readers, and therefore we seems to me we ought to be reading that which is going to be producing the Christian style and the Christian understanding, it seems to me that it's tragic that we are so unresponsive to the imagination, to anything that has this quality of expanse in it, of another world. You know, it isn't, it's just not just stones. You know, it's not just grass, it's not just earth, it's God's earth. And it's God's universe, and we're part of it. And it's an exciting, great adventure to be a human being. And we kind of get so nitty-gritty, and I do anyway, forgetting about the joy and the delight that there is in being this kind of person. And that's what I believe that novels and fairy tales for children, poetry, drama, art can do for us. But you know, you have to take some time to expose yourself to this, because it doesn't just come with your morning coffee or the morning newspaper or the 7 o'clock show, the Today Show, or your favorite evening television or Reader's Digest or our Lutheran Standard or whatever yours is. I mean, you know, it doesn't come in the ordinary channels. You've got to let yourself be aware of it and be exposed to it. And then you begin to see, as somebody said about George MacDonald, that he was like sort of a St. Francis of Aberdeen, Scotland was where he lived originally. And that he began to, you began to see that there was a halo around a flower and a bird and a tree. That they had a beauty that was different from just in and of itself. It had a quality of being holy because it had been made by God. But the great thing about it is that it's not just the artistic in terms of the way a poet can look at that, as this man said. He can look at it and he can see that it has a strange and unusual beauty, but he'll remain sad after he's seen it. But the Christian, when he sees the tree and the bird and the flower with the halo of life from God about it, he can go off in joy because he knows that it's his Father's world. It's his Father's creation. And you don't just, you know, go along in a jingle about it, but you think about it. I think sometimes we sing it off and that's the end of it. And we really, in order to enjoy it, you have to kind of let yourself meditate on it and consider it. And I think when Jesus said, consider the lilies, you don't consider something by saying, yeah, I saw them, now what next? When you consider something, you're going to sit with it. And that's what imagination does for you. That's what poetry does, that's what art does. That's what all these things are for. The wonderful thing about George MacDonald's writing is that besides the fact that he gave to children and adults this great world of the imagination, and that he was able to stimulate people to think about things and other worlds, other existences sort of moving around them in a kind of a fairy-like way that made it exciting and fun, so they didn't have to depend on Superman and the outer space people for their stimulation. He was also able, in a remarkable way, to get at some of the greatest social problems of that particular period in English society. And as I said last week when I talked about him, I think one of the funniest things about him is that he, these books were beautiful, they were considered, you know, this was the thing to do, to give one of George MacDonald's books to your children for a gift, and these Victorian grandmamas would give these books away, and never knowing that inside these books were just really remarkably astute and styled in such a way that they would hit the children, astute remarks on the social evils that were prevalent, the problem of the miners' children, of the poverty stricken, of the inequality that there was in life, and of not least the George MacDonald's own distaste for the English servant class, because he felt that the servants were just as interested in keeping up the caste system as anybody else. They weren't, you know, the servants in England were not the lower class. They weren't the people that were really down on. They were people that were, you know, they came to the door and they opened the door and they were the doorkeepers. And George MacDonald always felt that they were sort of a symbol of a holding up the caste system. You know, sort of their importance was they really didn't care whether they were the head of the house, but they were important because they could get the people out of the way. What are you, just a peddler? Out of the way. No, you can't see him today. And bang goes the door. You know, this is really it's got a lot of other ramifications when you read it as a person yourself. You can see a lot of your own, at least I can see a lot of my own tendencies in that. You know, the feeling of wanting to be important in little places. This is George MacDonald just detested this, and he was very clear on it. And I'm sure that a lot of those ladies that gave their grandchildren these books never knew what kind of combustible material was in that book. But that's what's fun about it. And, you know, a lot of people don't know it when they give a Bible away, but then they're pretty sure nobody will read it. It's a thing to do, and since it's a thing to do, nobody, they do it, but they don't read it. So that makes it, you know, kind of handy.
Well, here's the catalog.
Or a handy cross. I wore this also because I Terry gave it to me one day, and he said I'd given him a book to look at that had a lot of different crosses in it. And this is a cross that has a cross on the outside and inside, as David, the black-haired boy, one of the staff boys, said, looked right away and said, "That's a cross, but say, isn't that the swastika? Isn't that the Nazi cross inside?" And I said, "Yeah, it is. Not a lot of people know it." You want to know how when this cross came from? It came from the time of the Vikings, long before anybody knew. Isn't that, you know? And this is why it can be perverted, because it's deep in the natural life of the world. But the great thing about it is that Christ could be on that kind of cross and could sanctified. I mean, it became the crossroads. But there's something about the cross that is basic to mankind. It appears all over in the history of cultures. And I think I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is exactly what, you know, what my reaction was too when I first looked at the book. And then I thought, well, you know, after all, you know, God is greater than any of us or any of our interpretations, and He can use what He will. And when Jesus came and died on the cross was a nasty thing. We've made it a holy thing, because to us it's salvation. But in and of itself, it still is a nasty form of death. And it's strange that it always has had this strange symbol of being a crossing of the vertical and the horizontal, crossroads as far as decisions, crossroads as far as meeting places. All these things are involved in this one thing. And it's interesting that this is the kind of thing George MacDonald would say, well, you know, this is what we're supposed to think about. And the exciting thing about all of his writing is that he never allows you to say, as many people do, and I'd like to read this because I think it's really a a marvelous little thing. He said it was something that was written about him, not by him, but it was the idea that our little minds, we can't understand God. You know, we all say His ways are too mysterious for us, you know, and we can't think about it. But then you read the book of Job, and you realize that book is there. It's part of our canon. It's part of our scriptures. And what is that book but a thought-provoking, probing, concerned inquiry and involvement in the why of suffering, the why of evil. And you realize that that's not sin to think about it. It's sin when you say, my God is too small, I can't think about Him, because if I think about Him, maybe He isn't there. He's maybe not big enough for my thoughts, as if that's possible. But that's what we, you know, that's what our tendency is. We're so afraid that God isn't big enough. If He was big enough to make our minds, I think he can handle them. He's bigger than we are. And the interesting angle that I think you notice in all works of art and imagination is that they make you realize that the air you breathe and the world in which you walk is a part of God's creation. It's part of the affirmation of the fact that God said that the world was good when he made it, that originally it was meant to be good, and that in the incarnation and in the redemption, we walk in a world that is redeemed, and therefore we can look on it with redemptive eyes. And that makes us different kinds of people. But you know, you gotta let your imagination run a little bit if you're gonna start thinking about this. You can't just stay in just the narrow little grooves, because then you just get rather patterned. And you find that as you read books like this and as you live with them, that they become a candle of the Lord to search out your heart, and you find that your own scriptures that you've loved maybe all your life take on new and more glorious meaning, because you realize that there's so much more in them than you ever thought, because you've started to consider the lilies, you've started to think about the birds of the air, you've started to look at the grass of the field and realize that this is what Jesus has told us to do. And this is why we can let our imaginations go and think about the great wonders that we have, because we are redeemed, that we are sons and daughters of God, and that we can live in this world that does indeed belong to him. So I would strongly recommend that you expose yourself to C.S. Lewis at least, and those of you who are brave and who have a public library, look up George MacDonald and see if you can find At the Back of the North Wind or The Little Light Princess, because both of those books are really fun children's books and would give you quite a different kind of feeling about your spare time than if you just read what we usually do as women, what I do very often. You read the articles that appeal to you or that you know about somebody is sick, and then you read the recipes and what to do about your house and how to make your budget stretch. But let your imagination stretch.
Why can't we have these stories by these Christian authors on TV, Saturday mornings?
Oh, they wouldn't interest people. I mean, they would, but they would have to be, they'd have to be done in style and in a great deal, with a great deal of excitement. And I think they might be, it could very well be that somebody, my oldest daughter, who's very interested in theater, did start writing a little play on the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But they'd make an exciting series. Real good idea. Maybe you ought to follow that up. Letters help.
It's more than a letter, I think.
No, it does. It does. But it is true, though, that I think you might have a real tiger by the tail there if you pursued it.
The Saturday mornings TV.
I know.
Glued to them. And
I know.
It's horrible what they watch.
I know, and they never watch the uplifting ones that you plan on their watching. I always say, well, why don't you look at this one? And Sunday mornings or something after you get home from church, and well, the Hardy Boys are on. The Hardy Boys. I think they're good too, but you always say, well, you should learn something about something, lifting, but they don't, kids don't want to do that. But if you can, and that's why these books are interesting, and that's why I say you can't figure that Sunday school novels are going to appeal to them. Grace Livingston Hill was all right in 40 years ago, but boy, she's not gonna turn any teenager that I know on. And these books are really fun, and the interesting thing is that the adult books that follow them or that can be read along with them are equally interesting, but they have longer descriptive sections, and so I don't always talk about them, because I think sometimes people need to take in, if they haven't been reading this kind of literature, it's better to start with the children's books. But C.S. Lewis has written some really neat science fiction, really good. Out of the Silent Planet, and Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength.
And read them in that order.
Out of
the Silent Planet.
They're in paperback, and you run into them quite often in bookstores because they're science fiction. But you know, they've got the whole bit in them. You don't have to sit around like a detective trying to find the thread, but you'll come out of it with an expanded Christianity that just, you know, you're just so glad you're a Christian, it makes you want to jump up and down. There's not a thing about Jesus Christ in the whole thing, though. What?
They really aren't children's books.
No, these are the adult books.
Yeah, but what we really need is something like a Narnia series set in a more contemporary setting.
Yeah, but you see, the Narnia series were written, they were just written in the 40s.
Yes, I know, but they still deal with talking animals.
Yeah, but you see,
Disney could do
yeah, but you see, the thing is that a lot of kids they'll take the talking animals if they've been captured by the idea in the first place. But I do think, Ed, that you're right. It just irks me that we don't have more writing done in this vein.
Yes.
We get so much of the Dr. Seuss stuff and that kind of business, and it's always this obvious, you know, teaching stuff, but to capture by indirection, which is what Jesus did and what you got to do, I don't know. I think it's a real challenge, and I hope that if any of you have